Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Game Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rudolf Inderst, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to John Wills about his book, Gamernation, Video Games and American Culture. In his book, he examines how video games co-opt national landscapes, livelihoods, and legends, arguing that video games toy with Americans' mass cultural and historical understanding. John shows how games reprogram the American experience as a simulated reality. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rudolf, and great to be here on the New Books Network. Thanks for the opportunity.
John, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself. Of course, including your favorite video game and the one or the ones you're playing currently.
Thanks, Rudolf. Well, I'm a cultural historian at the University of Kent in the UK, and I focus on American popular culture, and I've kind of branched into game studies over recent years. In terms of playing video games, that's a longer story than my academic story. I've been playing video games since I was a child in the 1970s, so I was probably one of the first generation of gamers, I guess. And one of my earliest experiences is playing a Breakout, that kind of tennis bat and ball game, at the local, in the UK, fish and chip shop. So playing a game when I was growing up in the arcade there. I would say that, yeah, definitely I'm a gamer, and my dedication has varied across the eras, but I have a few favorite machines and favorite video games. I have my own MD Vectrex from the early 1980s, and I like Sega machines like the Saturn and Dreamcast. And in terms of video games, I guess things like Daytona USA, GoldenEye on the Nintendo 64, Shenmue, and more recently video games like Fire Emblem, Three Houses, Wasteland 3 on the PlayStation 4 I like. And currently I'm playing Metroid Dread, which is a kind of retro video game title. So yeah, I still play video games, but yeah, my job sometimes gets in the way a little bit, but yeah, I'm definitely a gamer.
Now, isn't that something we're all struggling with, right?
Yes, that's right. Trying to balance our playing careers.
So circling back to your recent publication, how did you actually come to write Gamernation?
Well, around 20 years ago, which is a long time actually, I wrote an article exploring how video games depicting nature. At the time, I think I just finished a PhD in US environmental issues. So I was interested in how do we depict the natural world. But I was also, as I said, a gamer. And I thought, oh, how do video games tackle the organic? How does the digital tackle the organic world? So I wrote a piece there, but I left it. I didn't really go back to it. I didn't explore games that much, which in retrospect, I probably should have done. And then about 10 years ago, I wrote an article on how the American West was set, you know, how games about the American West explored American history. And that led me to get funding from the British Academy to research depictions of America. So a bit of a broader title in video games. And that was a really kind of, as academics know, you know, getting some research funding is really important. And it allowed me to work on Gamernation, the book. It also allowed me to exhibit some of my research at the British Academy. And you know, I started writing this title for Johns Hopkins, exploring really my sense of enthusiasm and interest in American amusements, and exploring specifically how games do that. Yeah, it kind of flowed quite organically, but over quite a long time frame, probably longer than I'd imagined, because I get caught up in other projects at the same time.
Yeah, it's like, but this is something that also, I guess, is something we as gamers, so to speak, know very well. We have to, from time to time, we have to stop and rely on our safe games and then pick it up later again.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, I am one of those people. I will save a game and then come back to it sometimes a few weeks or a year later, but I also have no clue what I'm doing. So hopefully that's not a problem in my academic work, but yeah. I have those things go on. Yeah.
Well, you decided to let your version of a ludic America start in the 1960s and 70s. Additionally, you do introduce the concept of frontier to your readers. Now, I'm pretty sure this is exactly where you had the attention of all U.S. history scholars and teachers alike. Could you please take us through your thoughts here?
Yeah, of course. One thing to say, you know, quite naturally is, you know, the ludic play is part of the human condition. It's also part of the animal condition. You know, if you have a cat or dog at home, Rudolph, I don't know whether you do, but, you know, you see play as something that, you know, every living thing naturally does to some degree. And so, you know, our ludic past, our playing past is obviously dates back to our beginnings. Naturally, with this project, I'm not going to go anywhere near that. And so, you know, I have to be arbitrary and choose somewhere to start a kind of project on ludic America, what time frame to look at. And yeah, I chose the 60s and 70s to chime and correspond with what, you know, what we might call a kind of digital turn or a video game turn, and the emergence of a new form of digital play. But as you know, the ludic and play, you know, vastly precedes that, and you know, and also games precede that. You know, Johan Huizinga's book on play is from the 1930s, and we there's a longer history there. But for me, you know, looking at the video game turn, looking at video games as a kind of manufactured product, you know, we really need to, you know, home in at that genesis period of the 60s through 70s. I think it's also important, and I think I've done a little bit in Gamernation to do this, to make a nod that video games and digital play don't just come from nowhere. You know, that they connect not just with ideas about play, but they connect with industries that are already well established, amusement spaces such as, you know, places like Coney Island. Further back, they connect with sports like bowling, soccer, tennis, etc. That they're not just happening in a vacuum. They come from other, you know, fascinations with play. but certainly, yeah, for me, I chose that period. And they also reflect a burgeoning time of play for, in the United States anyhow, for the middle classes, more free time, more affluence, which gives us, you know, energy and space for more playtime. I think that's an important aspect too. In terms of the frontier, yes, it's a big word, isn't it? I can remember when I was looking at Western history, when I was doing my PhD back in the 1990s, and I read an article about, I think it began with the line, the new F word, or you know, how loaded it is, but also how offensive it can be too. In my work, I'm drawing on, you know, my tradition as a kind of Californian Western historian, and the frontier does come to mind. It's an American powerhouse of a term. There's a whole mythology around it, as you know, a kind of epic voyage and a discovery element to it. In terms of games, what I'm trying to do there is to get a sense of, in that time frame, there's a sense that the games connect with fascinations with a new technological frontier, the sense of future gazing that happens in the United States. I'm thinking in terms of world fairs at Seattle and New York in the 1960s, that fascination with the space age, the military-industrial complex, which is really exploring computer uses. And, you know, JF Kennedy talks of a new frontier. There's a sense whereby the frontier is not so much backward-looking but forward-looking in that period. And I think video games and video game technology, it, you know, is a little bit part of that picture of future gazing. And that's the kind of sense I'm trying to pick up on here. I'm certainly not trying to argue, however, of kind of keeping alive old frontier values or, you know, some of the problems. But I do think there's a kind of technological frontier happening.
Mm. Well, if I get you correctly, you're also talking about, or you do understand games as a, let's say, driver of technology then, right?
Yes, I think that often it's underestimated the impact that games can have on industries, technology, and the public. We tend to see games as a soft thing, a kind of soft technology, something that's frivolous, escapist. But actually, if we start exploring games in a serious sense, we realize that they're part of much more. You know, the fact that some of the earliest games were tied into developing, you know, nuclear or military strategy, or working out what computers can actually do, it shows that there's a serious side to games and to play that we tend to push to one side, I think, in our culture and sometimes in our scholarship too.
Yeah. It's funny though, because since the ubiquitous term of gamification seems to be one of the honey and favorite words of people dealing with business nowadays, but only in these terms, in these terms of achievements and trophies and rewards. But you also talk about another aspect of it when you're talking about taking games serious, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're 100% on with the buzzword of gamification. And well, I think there's an element of seriousness in game studies and thinking about how games can, you know, shape how we function. Yeah, it's definitely a kind of in thing at the moment. Certainly wasn't there in earlier decades, but we have that term there. I am definitely arguing for kind of, yeah, a more thoughtful and reflective sense of how we engage with video games. I think that's incredibly important, and to not get caught up in kind of old stories of video games, but to try to revisit the topic and find new ideas about them is important too.
Great, yeah. In your second chapter, then, you bring together games that focus on the American West in the 19th century and video arcade titles from the 1970s and 80s. Now, I must confess, I had to smile reading this very chapter, since one of my students told me recently that she was very sorry to have missed this great time period of arcade entertainment. And of course, I had to ask her where she might have stumbled upon the depiction she had in mind. And guess what? Of course it was, ta-ta, Stranger Things.
That's a brilliant story. And I think a few of my students have said that too, because I teach a module on games and history. And there's now almost a little bit of a mythology or novelty, at least, over imagining what arcade spaces were like and what arcades were like in the 1970s and early 80s. I think, yeah, we are now caught up in nostalgia for that period. There's a special fondness, isn't there, as there is, you know, for a generation or two ago. It's currently for the 1980s, and we can see that just in terms of what the last few weeks, the Top Gun movie, people have a kind of recreated romantic eye on that period. And I think video games are one of those big popular culture items from that period. And for those who didn't have those lived experiences, they're now watching them, aren't they, through Stranger Things and other programs. I think it's also, yeah, it is an interesting time. There's some new work coming out on, you know, arcade spaces. There's a sense of understanding them as distinctive social areas. We also have, you know, this is a great time when the first video game genres are decided. You know, what does a video game do? What sort of games are there? It's a time of exploration and inventiveness. And a lot of the games that we play today are still based around ideas and concepts that come from that period. In terms of the American West in games, naturally, again, because my PhD was on California, I had a sense of, you know, how has the American West been depicted? And for me, it's very interesting how, you know, traditional stories such as those of the West were sometimes, not always, but occasionally used to draw people into what was a new media item, to draw people into video games and a new technology. The great example of this is the Midway series of two arcade machines, Gunfight and Boot Hill, which were arcade westerns. They were set around a duel between two cowboys. And the interesting thing is that people approach those cabinets, which also looked very old west in arcades. So that's why I always think that was quite intriguing. People would come to those cabinets and they didn't need any instruction. They didn't need to be told what to do. They might not have even played a video game before, but they just looked at the screen and they saw two cowboys with guns on that screen, very pixelated and basic ones, I should say, and they knew what to do. The story of the West eased them into learning how to play a video game. And I think that's an interesting idea that we can use old stories to ease us into a new technology. And people did like those games. Those two were commercially successful alongside, you know, other titles that were more forward-looking with their frontiers, such as, you know, the classic Space Invaders. I think it's also intriguing how at that time also we have the demise of the commercial Hollywood Western. People are moving away from the Western after it being dominating the cinema and the TV, for that matter, from the 30s through to the 60s. The Western is no longer that popular, but instead video games, you know, start picking up the West in a few times. And we also have you know, this space western of Star Wars, and how Star Wars type games become really, really popular and maybe quite fundamental to driving video game success in the late 70s and early 80s. And again, that's something actually I don't explore in Gamer Nation, but it'd be quite intriguing to do that interface. And the final point to make is one of the other great things about this is that games like Gunfight, Boot Hill, and later westerns, they give players the ability to shoot back, to interact with the West. If we look at arguably the first Western, cinematic Western, The Great Train Robbery from the early 20th century, there's an amazing scene in it whereby Justice D. Barnes, a cowboy on screen, points his gun at the cinema audience, or at that time kind of vaudeville theatres, and shoots at the audience. Obviously not you know, they don't get hit, but a lot of the people watching apparently did, you know, duck or wonder what to do, or were scared because they were facing somebody with a gun. And it's really important how video games, this is the first time in a sense they get to shoot back. You know, and they manage to interact with that story for themselves and not be a voyeur, a victim, or just the audience with it.
Mm. Two thoughts here. When you are saying that the great Western productions, the film productions, were some sort of what they had also, what these developers, these early developers had in mind. We are talking about the classical U.S. Western, not the, let's call them, gritty Italian post-Western era, right?
Yeah, I think these games such as Gunfight and Boot Hill, I mean, Gunfight is actually modeled on a Japanese title. They're very simple, and that they lack really a sense of strong narrative. They don't get into the ultra-violence or darkness of those Italian Westerns. Really, they're just a simple basic model of a duel in the West. They'd be more aligned to movies such as High Noon than a later kind of Italian Western, because they don't have the panache or the style of those later ones either, and then certainly not being satirical. I think that comes later with some of the kind of visual homages to Italian Westerns that start coming on with when games have a bit better graphics, when they have a bit more sound. You start seeing, or hearing, I should say, Ennio Morricone kind of inspired music in video games. But these first ones, yeah, they're just two cowboys shooting. There's not much else to it, really.
Yeah. Now, in my second thought, actually, and I might skip here some years, but I was instantly thinking about 2006, when Native American organizations have filed a complaint with publisher Activision for the portrayal of tribes in their Western shooter Gun. And this really was way before all these talks about, let's say, games are too political and stuff. But also in 2006, this took place, and I also had to think about how this was the latest in line of a marginalized groups who are taking offense at content and are demanding fair representation.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because video games have attracted a range of controversies over the years, you know, from moral panic to some quite serious accusations around how they depict people. And, you know, Native Americans have been depicted in highly stereotypical and often downright offensive imagery in video games since their inception. You know, if we look at older titles, there's, you know, the commonly cited Custer's Revenge in the early 80s that depicts, in reality, you know, you take control of Colonel Custer and really kind of rape a Native American woman on the screen. I mean, it's an adult title, and it was designed to be offensive, I think, really. And certainly, you know, the American Indian movement boycotted it and protested against that one. I think that on those are particularly good, and that one are particularly offensive titles. But it also highlights how, you know, the video game industry has been, you know, has often repeated stereotypes from other media. They've also not taken much note of the opportunities of video games to highlight diversity, to kind of show different viewpoints on the past or on America. Instead, they've often played to, you know, the simple common denominators and ideas over what will sell best. I think those have come into some of those kind of commercial and design ideas. I think that it also plays to that formula, as you were saying, kind of old Western movies, whereby, you know, they don't show the West from a native perspective. Hardly, you know, very few films do truly do that. And video games are, again, kind of regurgitating, rehashing, and revisiting a white perspective on that West, on that frontier story.
Yeah. Well, as a great fan of Matthew Broderick, the next chapter talking about war games, really great pleasure. So in chapter three, you explore, and I quote here, you explore the potential ramifications of nuclear conflict, of course, within the Second Cold War and the political rise of Ronald Reagan. You achieve this by taking a very close look at games such as Missile Command and War Games. Since presumably I was the worst and most unsuccessful player of Missile Command back in the days, chances of me being the one saving us from the dangers of nukes falling down are zero to none. So is there actually anything I can do to help?
I love the question. I'm sure you're better at it than some people. but I mean, firstly, I should say Missile Command, you know, a video game from the early 1980s, released by Atari, and the game is an action game whereby you defend, usually I think it's four or five cities from incoming missiles, which were originally designed to be ICBMs, nuclear missiles, raining down on your cities. And you attempt to shoot them down using your own technology, creating these quite spectacular at the time pixel kind of clouds. And the aim of the game is to last as long as you can, to stop these missiles coming in and destroying your cities. And you know, the fact that, you know, maybe you weren't the best player in the world. I mean, maybe that's the point, that ultimately we were all helpless when faced with nuclear war. Even if you were good at the game, you might last, say, 10 to 15 minutes, but you would lose. All your cities would ultimately be destroyed. There wasn't the option to, you know, somehow fend off nuclear attack forever, or to beat the game. You'd just last as long as you could, but you would fail. And there's a powerful story in Missile Command about vulnerability limits, and that we can't ultimately prevent nuclear attack. So there's certainly that aspect in, you know, to that story. The game also, in a more game studies way or game history way, it kind of clicked in with the whole arcade way of play in the early 80s, that you face waves of attack, you're focused on high scores, you last as long as you can, and you don't simply complete the game. Missile Command in that way is quite kind of typical of that era. And in some ways, people probably played that game and never got any sort of political or nuclear message from it. They were probably just seeing it as just another game, almost like Space Invaders, of shooting things down. I do love some initial ideas behind the design of Missile Command. It's a really interesting case study. The one I really like is that originally they suggest, the development team suggested, that the arcade version of it would be shipped across the country, or globally too, and your local towns would be programmed into the game as the places that you were set to defend. So the idea that, you know, you would defend your local city from nuclear attack while playing the game. And I think that's a really interesting idea of kind of making games interact with kind of where you live, and to make them have some sense of realism, even when the graphics at that time are very rudimentary. War Games is a great film, and there's also a video game based on it too, which is quite natural given that it was involving a computer and a computer game as the subject of the film. And I think it's interesting how with War Games it speaks to kind of both an obsessiveness but also an anxiety over what computers can do if we give them autonomy, and what technology is capable of if it becomes somehow sentient. We get later films, don't we, such as the Terminator series, and they're all kind of exploring what can machines do, and the issue of kind of the sentient machine and the danger of that machine. But they're also kind of homages to it, aren't they, too? I mean, if I watch War Games or Terminator again today, I'm struck by their enthusiasm for that subject matter. So they're doing both there. Yeah.
So circling back to our utmost famous Green Beret, Ronald Reagan. Right, he was it wasn't Ronald Reagan, of course, it was another actor, right? But our famous ex-president, U.S. President Ronald Reagan, the way he was, correct me if I'm wrong, but I always got the feeling the way he was portraying characters back in his days, aside from a few productions, was a rather, if you really want to achieve something, you can do it. Hard work pays off mentality. So how would you combine these, let's say, rather bleak foresight of a game like Missile Command with the strong and powerful message of achievement and performance of someone like Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, I mean, Reagan's an important figure in that period. I mean, he's the 1980s president. He's recognized as he's tied to ideas about American superpower status, about winning the Cold War in the period. And, he also makes use of almost like video game imagery and sci-fi imagery when he launches his SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, in the early 80s. And it gets the moniker of a Star Wars program, whereby he has the idea that the United States can be defended against any nuclear attack by creating lasers and having this very kind of fictional landscape of defending the United States against the Soviet Union. And I think that in a way, how we might see some of the games of the time, they capture a little bit of that power, that directness, that simplicity, the idea that you can become a hero in the video game and single-handedly take on the Soviets or whatever the enemies are. The Rambo series with Sylvester Stallone in it, there's a sense of, again, this kind of masculinity and this conquering of any threat. And to a degree, I played some Commando games, some Rambo games from the period. They're very kind of cartoony, but they do give a degree of kind of empowerment to them, and certainly this binary world of heroes and villains, and that you're on the good side and every single character you come across in the game is on the bad side and you just get rid of them. There's such a simplicity and naivety over gamescapes and those ideas. And I think Ronald Reagan, when he situated the Soviet Union as the evil empire and the kind of villain of the world, he was doing the same sense of appealing to our wanting of binaries, that we're the good guys and they're the enemies.
Yeah. Do you sense some sort of comeback given the current political situation with Russia?
I don't know yet. I think that the Call of Duty series has at times traded in those sense of binaries. I think that you know, Donald Trump, his whole platform of making America great again was trading again in kind of binaries and this sense of America as the hero nation. You know, that there's elements of that that actually, to some extent, presage, you know, the immediate threat of the Russia today. I think maybe in the US setting, it's been going on for a few years actually. Whether they have kind of fully, whether video games have fully explored that, I don't think they have yet. But they've certainly traded for some time in simple ideas of heroes and villains.
I see. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. John, the next chapters take a bit of a jump forward on our timeline then. Chapters 4 and 5 do center around the attacks of 9/11 and the following what has become known as the War on Terror. Furthermore, you also pose a very interesting question. And I quote here, do games of the 2000s play a similar role as Rambo films of the 1980s? In dealing with national trauma? Well, I have to ask then, do they?
I mean, to some degree, there's a sense of rescuing America in these titles. You know, 9/11 was a huge, traumatic and startling event that started the 21st century. And, you know, an attack on American home soil, you know, is a huge deal, and naturally so. I think that it's inevitable that 9/11 shapes popular culture as well as, you know, military actions such as the War on Terror. Video games actually struggle in a sense to respond to that event because they're seen as too frivolous and too lightweight to take on the heaviness of 9/11. So many of them at the time eliminate references to New York City. They simply don't go there. While Hollywood censures for a few years, video games stay well clear of 9/11 because it's such a hallowed ground and it's such a serious topic, and that's one issue there. But I think what they do, and which is the point I think I was trying to make with that chapter, is they explore it, but from a broader, more abstract idea of getting back at terrorists, or rescuing America, or winning a war, it may be on a video game, but you're still winning the war and beating terrorists. And, you know, citizens who lived through 9/11, maybe they do want a sense of feeling important, not feeling powerless, feeling like they're doing something. And those video games, to a small degree, they offer some sense of reward and catharsism by you playing them and you beating the terrorists, you winning the game for America. I think that's the kind of thing I was trying to explore a little bit there. Obviously, it is still not on a kind of serious level of engagement. And it does highlight how sometimes video games have struggled with serious events. A game that looked at the Columbine school massacre, for example, you know, that explored on some level what it was, you know, what that school killing was about, but was hugely lambasted in the press. I think that there's a fine line, and video games can still have a sense of being criticized and being looked at very critically when they deal with serious topics.
Yeah. Do you share the belief that, or the estimation that we're talking mostly about action titles or shooter titles? Because I was just thinking, wouldn't this have also been a possibility for, let's say, I don't know, strategy games or I'm not so sure, but maybe even thinking of construction, you know, building simulators or rescue missions within the Twin Towers, in order to get help or finding missed peoples, something like this.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting and original point, isn't it, that you made there? Because actually what happens is, you know, we get mainstream first-person shooters. We get games about killing, and those are games also whereby we have the first-person point of view on these things. They're a lot more visceral, they're very action-orientated, and they're often a bit more linear in terms of narrative too, the game being didactic and telling us how to think a little bit. Yeah. Those have been the more common forms, but we haven't explored other ways of treating these topics and other gamic ways of treating them. I think your idea of rescuing, there were a few kind of fire surface games, but not ones focused on 9/11 that have come out over the years. But it's interesting, these are not games that people, you know, buy. They're not the commercial mainstream titles. And as the criticism of the industry has been for some time, you know, it gets caught in certain genres and certain types of game, doesn't it? Whereas there's a lot more opportunity to explore history, to explore politics, you know, from different approaches and different game ideas.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like the broader concept of let's call it urban life sprung up really with the GTA titles then, right? And this is also something that leads us to my next question, because with a simple push of a button, we can digitally traverse hundreds and thousands of miles in an instant today. And this is exactly what you do in your seventh chapter then. You leave New York City behind, how could you, and settle down at the West Coast in order to gain a deeper understanding of the way developer powerhouse Rockstar has reimagined their version of a Los Angeles. So while it seems that every gamer out there, including me, is waiting for the next iteration of GTA, what did you find out by examining the ones already existing?
Yes, and also the book, it highlights how the book does jump around a bit, doesn't it? When we're jumping from one end of the country to the other. I think the GTA series, I mean, firstly, it's incredibly important. GTA 5 is the most successful entertainment product in existence. And that's a big statement when we think about, you know, competition from Marvel or Star Wars. GTA highlights the pervasiveness and the purchase that video games have in today's society. GTA, in terms of interpreting it, I mean, it's a rich canvas there to look at. Sometime I was trying to think of how to approach it, and on some levels it reminded me, this might seem offensive to some historians, but it reminded me of thinking about, say, Alexis de Tocqueville visiting the United States and writing about democracy in America.
Or, but John, how could you?
Yeah. or like Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur, you know, talking about farming for the first time in America. You're basically an outsider coming to the United States, critiquing it, observing it, questioning it, writing about it. And you know, GTA, certainly its early iterations, provides, you know, at times a British and at times an international view on America. It's cynical, it's satirical. And like Tocqueville and Crèvecoeur, it's also intrigued and obsessed with the country. It's both appalled, but at the same time attracted to it. I think, you know, if you read maybe like Jean Baudrillard's America and then played GTA 5, it'd be surprising that at times some of the comments, the satire, the imagery, actually, you know, they would enrich each other by doing that. And I think we learn a lot from this observation of, at times a fake, but at times disturbingly real version of Los Angeles. And I've spent some time in LA, and you can kind of get some of the points that GTA 5 does make about it. I love the satire. I love how it has multiple levels of satire, how the game employs a kind of environmental satire whereby you're in your car and you hear a radio show advert lampooning some sort of American product, or you drive by a billboard advertising again some sort of very stereotypical, US corporate move to win you over. But at the same time, there's some interesting points about satire in terms of the character Michael's own personal falling out with the American dream. There's so much to that game. And for me, there are deeper themes within GTA that you might explore over the crisis of masculinity in the 21st century. It's very much a male gaze that's offered in that title. And alongside all that realistic 3D world mapping, it's trying to explore to some extent male desires and frustrations. At the same time, I do feel obliged, I think, as I say a little bit in the chapter, but as we all know, that GTA has very much limits. You know, it's a game that's had lavished, you know, there's so much time has been lavished on this product and so much game industry time spent on it. And it's been kept alive in an online way, but it's still limited in terms of its perspective, its problematic gender kind of depictions. And, you know, it's a flawed product too, but certainly something that you can richly explore and get something from academically as well as just for pleasure, I would say.
Yeah. I was wondering, just a little speculation now, talking about the next GTA. I've heard I've come across the opinion that it would be tough as nails to come up with with GTA 6, because with all the debates and discussions about fake news and social media, it is hard to come up with another level of irony, really, and building up a form of meta critique of the current ongoings in US politics, for example. And this is something that would mean trouble to developers, finding an even ironical tonality, because the truth is so utmost unbelievable things are going on at the same time, just on like Twitter or the identity politics discussion. It must be really tough for the next great GTA, right?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, when the series dates back, 20-25 years, you know, that it was clearly a pastiche or an obvious commentary on those things, whereas now, as you say, what's fake and what's real, and you know the pastiche seems to have become real at times, doesn't it? And how we differentiate those things. I think it's also a danger that, you know, people can play these titles without always recognizing the satire, and increasingly there might be the issue of, do people actually, you know, believe some of the billboards in the next iteration because they see them in real life? You know, it's a difficult one. I don't know. Also, I don't know much about, you know, programming on the next iteration. Perhaps there's also hopefully there's the opportunity though to bring in some better diversity and for once fix the kind of the absence of a legitimate female gaze. So I think that would be great for them to finally get round to.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the next chapter then, because as somebody with a great interest in research focusing upon unironical utopian media depictions and the given difficulties to even find them nowadays, your final book chapter has a special place in my heart. Almost 20 years ago, I briefly also conceptualized the online Ludo platform Second Life as an utopian possibility space while writing my dissertation about MMO guilds as political communities. Of course, that was before Deutsche Bank and Telekom were opening up their ghoulish ghost store fronts everywhere in Second Life. Now, though, that I have read through Chapter 7, I'm not so sure anymore. Was I wrong to dismiss Second Life's utopian potential? Help me out here, John.
I'm sure you weren't wrong or doing your research wrongly. I think there's a sense that Second Life can seem a little bit of a missed opportunity. Maybe it was a bit futuristic or before its time. Second Life was an exploration of digital living, the idea that you could basically move your life into what looked like pretty much a video game, and you know that would involve currency, it would involve relationships, it would involve building your own home, exploration, community, politics, all kinds of things. And to some extent, by around 2008-09, there were businesses moving into this online platform. There were political assemblies, there were protests. It seemed to have some kind of potential there to highlight how we could shift into a digital society more. I think problems came up in a sense, you know, the technology platform needed updating. It's also kind of went a bit mismanaged by Linden Labs, who created the game. But there's a powerful immersion value to it. And I think that maybe actually that kind of idea will increasingly speak to us again, that you can, you know, make a shift to digital living more, that you could maybe create your own kind of utopian space or found new relationships in the digital world. I love, when I explored the game, I love some of the reference in it. I mean, you had players or people who inhabited Second Life creating versions of Yosemite or, you know, great landscapes. And you had some very intriguing communities who had spent years online meeting up every day and clearly cared for each other. But I think there's a sense that, you know, some of the democratic rhetoric, some of the potential of what a digital utopia could be, that certainly had gone when I visited the game. In a sense, the reality of when I looked at Second Life was it was more a round of digital ruins and weird, some weird kind of cults online there. And so it was more a kind of dystopia than a utopia. And it also highlighted how, you know, online worlds are precarious things, and that, you know, something might grow for a few years, but then it could just be disconnected or disappear, highlighting how ephemeral these projects can be, however big or utopian they start.
So the metaverse, is it bound to be to become the next Second Life then?
I don't know. You tell me. It could well be. I think it's going to be a difficult prospect. I mean, we have kind of embraced digital lives on so many levels now, haven't we? That the idea of you know, getting that right, or one company or one idea dominating that. I think we're at the point whereby we have so many different choices and different interactions that it's hard for one thing to take hold.
Well, we have taken a lot of your time, so let's bring this thing to an end. What are you working on now? And of course, what will you be playing next?
Well, I've just finished an edited collection on Red Dead Redemption, the Red Dead series by Rockstar, with Esther Wright at Cardiff University. So Esther and I have put a lot of energy into that book, and that comes out in the spring, Red Dead Redemption, History, Myth and Violence, the Video Game West. I'm still working a little bit on Red Dead myself, looking at ideas about time in the game. That's what I'm currently interested in. And I'm trying to do a small exhibit on games for the Medway Gaming Festival, if I can get organized quick enough. In terms of playing, I need more time for this. I'm looking forward to a few kind of retro titles. I think there's a version of Advance Wars, Perfect Dark, Metroid Prime. There's a few oldies that are being reimagined that I'll probably be overexcited with, and then not enough time to play. But hopefully I will get there. That's about it, I think.
Yeah, so there's a lot to do. Sounds like a great project, though. I can't wait to get my hands on that Red Dead Redemption project you're working on. I want to thank you for you being on the show today, and I really enjoyed it. So take care and goodbye.
Thanks so much, Rudolph, and thanks for the opportunity. See you soon. Bye.